You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined by Stephen Knapp, president of George Washington University, a private institution in DC, 26,000 students. President Knapp, you've got a lot of things on your plate over there with that many students. What brings you to the UK?
Well, we have a community of alumni here and, of course, parents of students who are either currently enrolled at our university. First, I want to thank you for having the chance to talk on this podcast. I think that anything we can do to get more discussion of higher education at a rather trying and challenging time for higher education in both our countries is really valuable. But we like to engage with our alumni around the world. We have now more than 275,000 alumni, and we have increasing numbers of students coming from abroad. But we also have important partnerships and programs that we're involved with, and one of the things we're doing right now at our university is building a center for the study of Winston Churchill and his historical legacy, and using that as a window into the history of the 20th century and the transatlantic relationship. And so we've been here talking to some of our partners and friends who are interested in that project at our university. So this is being established on the ground floor of our university library this summer, and will be opening in the fall. It'll be called the National Center, the National Churchill Center and Library, and so that's one of the programs. We're here. I was talking to one of our alumni who is the head of the British Council, Sir Kieran Devan, who was on our campus in November and gave a major address there. And we're interested in the common mission that we have as an international educational institution, with the kind of cultural outreach that the British Council is involved in on behalf of the foreign ministry. And I think the whole question of cultural exchange, people-to-people relationships is important to us as a university, and certainly important to our country. So for all those reasons, we have a lot that to talk about here with our friends and partners in the United Kingdom.
There's a lot of Anglophiles, aren't there, in the US? This Churchill Centre very attractive to a lot of people thinking about studying.
Churchill's a widely admired historical figure, but it's not just about Winston Churchill as an individual, and it's also a controversial figure, of course, because of the history of colonialism, imperialism, and all the rest of that. And so I think that's important because it provides a window on a very complex and important period of global history that was especially important to the relationship between our two countries. And since we're in Washington, D.C., just blocks away from where the war, the Secretary of War's office was located during that period before the Pentagon was built. We know that Winston Churchill was walking the streets of our campus at various times. And so we think it's a natural place for us to kind of focus on this historic relationship. But we're interested in the broader history, not just in the individual.
You mentioned challenges, a challenging time, I think you said, for HE on both sides of the Atlantic. Now, in these podcasts, we usually start by asking about sort of the big news of the day in the US. Now, unfortunately, on this occasion, that's probably the shooting of an engineering professor, William Klug, at UCLA, reportedly by a former student who then killed himself. Now, I don't want to discuss that specific case, but this type of incident must have quite an impact on your staff. It must have an impact on you. I mean, how do you as a president react? Is it a difficult moment in which to lead a university?
Well, I think, in general, all of our public institutions are kind of in a state of alert and have been, because you never know when an incident like this is reported, whether it's an isolated matter of a domestic dispute or personal situation, or whether it involves, it could be a terrorist attack, such as has occurred around the world, or it could be what's called an active shooter who's actually randomly attacking people, as has happened rather tragically at the very beginning of my presidency. Right before I started, there was an incident at Virginia Tech in which a large number of students were shot and killed. As you may have been aware of that, this was in 2007, and one of the first things I did as president when I started in the fall of 2007 was ask for a review of all of our safety and security procedures and our mechanisms for alerting students if there was something like that happening on our campus, so we could be assured that we would be in the best possible position to guarantee the safety of our students through an alert system, which we wanted to make sure we had the most sophisticated possible way of communicating with our students. So we just did a review of that, and we continue to update that every so often, just to make sure that we're kind of in touch with best practices and we're aware that we're doing everything we can. But it is, our society is complicated by the availability of firearms, which is a pretty unique problem in our country. Right now, I think the state of Texas has passed a law that will enable students to carry weapons on campus, which I think many of us find very disturbing. You can't imagine having a really heated debate in a classroom if you're worried about, you know, how the person across the table might be armed. We don't think that's the best atmosphere in which to have academic freedom. But, you know, each state, you know, gets to determine its destiny. We don't have that situation on our campus. I think it would be very problematic if we did. But we do pay a great deal of attention to issues of safety and security. We have some advantages because we're, you know, our location right between the State Department and the White House does mean that we have a lot of overlapping police jurisdictions there. We have, in addition to the Metropolitan Police, our own police. We have the United States Park Police, the Capitol Police, the Secret Service. So we do a lot of drills, so we're prepared for emergencies. We have, I think, a very strong safety and security setup on our campus. But obviously, whenever anything like this happens, you know, it's always a source of concern, and we try to understand exactly what the circumstances were, just so we can make sure that we're in the best possible position to respond if we need to.
Do you think presidents could do more in terms of gun lobby type activities, in terms of, you know, discouraging the allowance of concealed carry on campuses in Texas? Do you think that the university sector is vocal enough, and so particularly leaders like yourself, in condemning those kind of...
Well, policies? I would. I mean, I think if something like that policy would be proposed in Washington, D.C., which is where my university is located, or in fact in the state of Virginia, where we have not only one of our campus, but a number of other teaching centers. We have three major campus presences, two in Washington, D.C., one in Virginia, but many other teaching centers throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia. If a proposal like that came here, I would certainly be among, I'm sure with my colleagues, very vocal in raising concerns about that. But the other way in which I think universities contribute is we do a lot of research on gun violence from a public health perspective. And I think we try to, you know, we're an educational institution, we try to make sure the public is informed, but we acknowledge that in our particular context in the United States, because of the Second Amendment of the Constitution, this is a very fraught issue with, you know, opinions are very sharply divided. I don't usually see my role as, you know, wading into partisan debates about these things, but I think when it impinges on the university, then I think I do have not only a right, but an obligation, responsibility to speak out and say, this is the effect I think this would have on the atmosphere on our campus, on the academic freedom, which is one of our most important values, the ability to have free and open debate. Anything that impinges on that, I think, goes right to the heart of our educational mission, and mm-hmm. I think therefore I really do have a responsibility to speak out, and I certainly would do that.
To what extent do you think that you know, universities can be sort of preventing sort of this kind of gun violence in the first place?
Well, you know,
in the sense where you can be talking to students about this, kind of raising more awareness.
Well, certainly. So we try to make sure that our students are aware of what, you know, what would happen if there was an emergency like this that occurred. That we were in touch with them. We have their we can communicate with them by cell, not just by, you know, email or some other means of communication. Because one of the things that happens if there's an emergency in a city, that often that jams up the phone lines, and you've got to find alternative ways of communicating. So a lot of this involves technology. A lot of it involves training, sensitization drills that we do. So, I mean, that, you know, obviously what we can't do is prevent someone from coming on campus who's armed in a society in which, you know, there are more guns than people. I mean, that's a reality that we face in the United States. And I don't know if there's anything you can do. We can't. Our campus is an open campus. We're part of the city of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been fortunate not to have an incident like this now, but, you know, we have to remain vigilant. And the only thing we can do is make sure our students are trained, are prepared, but not only that, but they are adequately supported by the kinds of systems we can put in place to protect them.
Okay, I mean, moving on from the sort of gun violence part, I mean, you've obviously been president of George Washington University for 9 years,
I think
it is.
Year, yes. Could
yeah, I mean, you mentioned about, you know, higher education being in a bit of a state of flux at the moment. How has the landscape sort of changed over those 9 years, and how do you maybe kind of see that evolving again in the future?
Well, I think the biggest challenge at the moment, which was brought to light, and actually to some extent created by the economic crash that took place 2007-2008, right when I was starting, what that has revealed is the stagnation of family income and wealth during a period in which labor-intensive industries like ours continue to increase in cost, right? Because we don't enjoy the kinds of productivity gains from technology that, say, the auto industry can enjoy. If you went to an auto factory 100 years ago and went to one today, it would be unrecognizable. In fact, I was recently at a factory in which I was impressed by the extraordinary agility of these robots that are able to photograph, something and then carve it to the exact shape that it needs to be and so on without any human being involved in that process. So, which of course is disruptive in terms of labor because it does put people out of work, but it does mean productivity gains. If you went to a classroom 100 years ago and a classroom today, the biggest difference would probably be that you'd have a whiteboard today instead of a blackboard then. But you'd have roughly the same number of faculty members relative to the number of students in those classrooms because it's a very labor-intensive activity. And there was a hope, I think, decades ago that computerization would suddenly open all kinds of possibilities for efficiencies in education. In fact, what computerization has done is added value by giving students more ways of gaining access to information and giving them more flexibility in how they can interact with the course material, which is a great thing, a great enhancement of the educational experience, but it hasn't saved any money. In fact, it's added cost because now we have to pay for those systems. We have to produce courses that are actually more expensive to manage, not less expensive. We're all thinking that at some point there may be a way in which someone will figure out how to reduce costs through the use of computerization, but that's not in fact occurred in our business. It hasn't. In other industries, it has, and as a result, the inflation rate at college and universities tends to be higher than that of the economy as a whole, because there isn't that kind of productivity gain. And when that's happening, so inflation goes on in our industry at the same time when family income and family wealth is flat, that means you have fewer and fewer families who can afford the cost of higher education. And we need to address that. One of the ways we've done it as an institution is by greatly, dramatically increasing since the crash. We have dramatically increased the amount of student aid we've provided from a little over 100 to around $200 million that we return every year from our tuition revenues in the form of student aid. And we've had to keep pace with that. And of course, as we do that, that cuts into the amount of resources we have to pay for everything we do, pay for operations. So I think that's a challenge. It's known as the challenge of the discount rate. In other words, what percentage of tuition revenue, instead of being used to pay for the operations of the university, to pay the faculty, to pay the staff, is used to support students so they can afford to attend. That problem has put a lot of pressure on many institutions. We've done pretty well, other institutions like ours, I think, have had the wherewithal to be able to maintain their programs well, still increasing the amount of student aid. But you've probably heard about the cases where some smaller colleges had to close because they couldn't, they were spending so much of their revenues just to help their students afford the education they were providing that they could no longer provide it. And so they've gone out of business. And I think that's a challenge that all of higher education is facing. At the moment, it happens to be a greater challenge at public universities than it is at a private university like ours. And I think it's important to say that, the kind of institution that I run, which is a private research university, is really a small part of the overall higher education picture in the United States. We're somewhere between 20-30% of higher education in the United States provided by private institutions. The large majority of our students across the nation are taught at public institutions, either two-year or four-year institutions. And in those cases, in the case of public institutions, since 2000, the actual cost of attending has gone up by 136%. In our case, it's gone up by 17%. We measure that in terms of the net tuition revenue, in other words, how much the institutions are actually deriving from their tuition. And that's an eightfold difference between public and private institutions. And what's happened is as state governments have defunded their universities and have shifted the cost from the states themselves to the students and their families, you've seen the cost of attendance increase at the very same time the family income is not keeping pace. So it's a greater challenge even at public institutions than it is at private institutions like ours, but it's a national issue that we're having to address.
Those increases might be less at private institutions, but they would start from a higher base, if you like.
So they would, except that, again, we provide so much, if you look at the so-called sticker price, in other words, what a family that pays the full cost is actually paying versus what the average student pays, It's a rather dramatic difference. So two-thirds of our students are on financial aid. Only about a third of them pay the full cost of attendance. and the rest are subsidized basically by the families that, that are full paying families. This is the high price, high aid model, which is, you know, which is a I think we all see is a challenging model to operate under and raises all kinds of questions and all kinds of concerns. But we haven't found an alternative because the alternative traditionally has been public funding, mm-hmm. and public funding is on the decline as a percentage of the total, and so that's where the challenge arises.
I mean, there's only one, you know, public institution in DC, the University of the District of Columbia. Like,
yes.
To what extent does their sort of success impact you? I mean, in some sense, are you, you know, you're always thinking that, that you could gain, it would be an opportunity for you to gain something if you know, they have issues in terms of, I don't know, recruiting faculty, or is there a sense that actually it's about the wider kind of higher education landscape within DC?
They're not, no, well, we really like to see them thrive because they provide opportunities for DC residents to have access to education, but they're much, you know, they're not really competitors with our university. And you know, they're part of our consortium of universities, but we don't. If we look at the schools with which we compete for, you know, that that they would not be in the group of students in the group of universities with which we compete. There are other state institutions that are large research universities like ours that would be more naturally would be competitors with our institution, like for example, the University of Maryland, which is also in our consortium and is a very high quality research university and provides a lower cost option, although now for out-of-state students they're getting pretty close to the cost that a student would face coming to our institution, and that's because the tuition for out-of-state students is not as regulated as it is for in-state students. But it is, you know, I think if it's always going to be the case that there'll be families going to try to decide between relatively lower cost public institutions and private institutions. We're holding our own at this point. In fact, our applications went up 29% this past year. You know, we haven't had any trouble filling our class. We do have a smaller percentage of the students we're admitting that are able to pay the full price than we did 10 years ago, and that's a challenge.
Let's ask a question that probably speaks to a number of themes, diversity being one. Before we started the tape rolling, we were talking about some of the incidents in Missouri where university presidents ultimately stepped down after rows with students on campus. I know there have been incidents at your own university down the years. I seem to recall one case of a student returning from India with a swastika, which of course is a sign of peace out there, that was hung on a notice board in a fraternity house, and that ended up being reported to the police as well. Do you feel in the US that as a president you're almost accountable for the behaviour of students? Things go awry in the student body, sometimes the president can be the one in the firing line.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are a couple different issues there. So the broader concern right now in American universities has to do with the fact that for students coming from minority communities, lower income communities, from families that are going to college for the first time, the question is how we ensure their success, not just their access to getting into college and or university, but actually succeeding there in an environment with which they may not have the preparation that some of their fellow students have if they come, for example, a family with generations of experience of going to college and that sort of thing. This is why President Obama in January 2014 invited a number of college university presidents to the White House for a summit on what was called access and success, both sides of that. How do you get more families prepared to send their daughters and sons to college, and how do we ensure that once they get there they succeed in an environment that their families may not be familiar with? One of the things we've been doing is going out in the community and helping families fill out their financial aid forms, which they didn't necessarily have any awareness of. And we've also been increasing our scholarship support for graduates from our local schools within the District of Columbia. We've had a program for many years, the Trachtenberg Scholarships, which provides a full scholarship support for a number of graduates from D.C. schools. And that's a sort of my favorite day every year is when I go out and surprise the students who have received these scholarships. And what's really inspiring about those moments is I walk into the classroom there with our somewhat scary mascot, who's a kind of, you know, giant-headed George Washington figure, and the dean of admissions, and I read the name of the student who's won the scholarship, and all the other students, not the ones who won, but all the fellow students of that person, just, you know, burst into applause and cheers and their hugs and tears and all the rest, because it's so inspiring to them to see the success that a student can enjoy with one of their own. And we do that in part to get out the message that college is a possibility in the future of of all of our students in the District of Columbia. And so we're trying to build that access. But then you also have to look at the other end of that is, once a student comes to an institution like ours, will they find the support mechanisms that will enable them to succeed? Will they be greeted by their fellow students who have had very different life experiences until that time? Will they encounter unconscious bias, which is a reality, I think, because assumptions are made. Just to give you one example, if there's a single African-American student in a class and an incident comes up, like one of the shootings that led to the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement last year, and the professor turns to that student and says, well, perhaps you can tell us what your community thinks about this. And all of a sudden, the burden is placed on them of representing, you know, the minority group from which they come. And that's a very daunting experience for any young person coming into college for the first time, and maybe as the first person in his or her family. So we have to respond to that, and I've been responding to it by just having a lot of open dialogue with our students about these issues and involving our deans. I had a conversation in the fall, which I think was very fruitful in terms of getting on the table a number of these issues, and then followed that up with a consortium meeting that was housed at Howard University in the district at the invitation of the president there, Wayne Frederick. And we had hundreds of students there and representatives from our universities, and we talked about how we can collectively address these issues. And then I engaged the deans in similar conversations with our students, and I think we're making some progress in identifying ways in which we can train faculty and also our students in ways of being more cognizant of what it's like to come into an institution like ours from a very different background from theirs, right? Because we live in a very de facto segregated society in which high-income families don't live among lower-income families. You know, that used to be the case, but now there's been a sorting out. I think that, I don't know if that's true here in the UK, it's certainly true in the United States, and as a result, they don't go to the same schools, they don't have the same experiences as they're growing up, and then they're thrust together, and the question is, how do they learn to communicate with each other without inadvertently sending signals that some people aren't welcome in the community? So we've got to address that, and that's a very serious matter that a lot of my fellow university presidents are involved in. And we've been fortunate to date, we haven't had incidents about this, we haven't had demonstrations. We've had very respectful and I think very constructive conversations with our students and our faculty and our deans about what we can do together to improve the situation. And I think we will be making progress, and that we are making progress. The incident that you mentioned, I mean, the kinds of things that happen where, you know, these sort of fluky things that occur where, a symbol is posted on campus that's controversial, and that causes a furor in the media, and then you have to respond. Sure, I find myself constantly having to make comments about things like that and address the community and try to calm the waters a little bit. The particular incident you mentioned, this was a Jewish fraternity in which all of a sudden a swastika appears on the wall, symbol of Nazism, right? As far as anyone knew, it turns out it was a souvenir that one of the students had brought back from India, where it's been an ancient religious symbol. But nevertheless, that created a furor because it was interpreted as an anti-Semitic gesture. And so, of course, that we had upset parents asking us why there were swastikas showing up on campus. So we had to deal with it. But, you know, that I wouldn't put that in the same category. Those kinds of misunderstandings or pranks or, you know, however you want to look at them that occasionally cause a media uproar are very different from the long-term and really challenging question of how you guarantee that students who come from backgrounds where they're not familiar with colleges and universities, where they don't necessarily have the same level of preparation in their schools, and they need to succeed in these institutions, what you need to do to ensure their success is a very different issue from how you deal with, media events.
Sure. Final question. I think we've only got a couple of minutes. So, Obama, coming to the end of his tenure, what do you think his legacy in higher education will be? Has it been a successful term? And then very quickly, Clinton, Trump, Sanders, what does the future look like under those three potential presidents?
Well, so in the case of President Obama, I already mentioned this this focus on access and success, and I think he really has kind of shine a light on the question of making sure that that everyone in our society has the opportunity to enjoy what higher education has to offer. That doesn't mean that everyone needs to go to a four-year college or needs to go on to graduate school or anything like that. I think we've a little bit suffered from the loss of some of the opportunities for learning skills that are employable outside of the traditional college track. And I think there are many students who have a wide range of talents and interests that are not being served that might have been under some of the older systems we had, where you could go into certain kinds of technical training and enjoy a fruitful career in that direction. I think there's a lot of talk about restoring that. But the key is, does everyone have... I mean, if you're going to have a democracy, you can't have a democracy where large groups of people or communities feel they're shut out of opportunity, right? And I think that that's been the focus that President Obama has brought to higher education with his interest in access and success. And you've seen that increasingly, Pell Grant funding, which is funding for lower income students, that has gone up significantly during his tenure. He's also, I think, brought to the forefront, or his administration has brought to the forefront, the concern about sexual assault, mm-hmm. which is something we could have a whole hour conversation about, that very complex and very challenging, very daunting issue on our college campuses. There's been some controversy over the precise way in which the administration has addressed that. Some feel that the administration has taken too punitive an attitude toward colleges and universities, who are really stuck with this challenge, which are not, you know, they're not criminal justice organizations, and they're having sometimes a hard time figuring out how to adjudicate complaints of sexual assault. But we're all working on it. We're all spending a lot of resources on doing that, and it's response to, I think, a very important initiative that was brought forth by the administration. So,
what do you think? Do you think it's been a successful?
I think we're still very much in the process of really understanding how we're going to deal with this reality. I'm very, very concerned about the prevalence of sexual assault and on our campuses. I think that's something that's come to light. We're doing now a much better job of understanding the nature and the magnitude of that problem. We've put a lot of resources into addressing it. I'm personally very concerned about it. But right now we're in a process of figuring out exactly how you adjudicate these cases, which are often, you know, involve conflicting testimony between two individuals as to what exactly took place, and then you have to figure out how you're going to negotiate that and come to a just and reasonable outcome. And I think universities that's not what they sort of were trained to do, and not what they've been good at doing, but we're learning how to do it. So that's still very much something in progress. What's going to happen under the administration on that issue, I have the vaguest idea. I don't think anybody really knows. Some of the proposals have been made about universities. I think we just have to look very closely at potential unintended consequences. I think the notion of giving free education to everyone, including wealthy families as well as non-wealthy families, could have unintended consequences of actually reducing the amount of resources available to support students from lower incomes. Because remember, I mentioned this high aid, high price model that we have.
So that would be the Sanders approach could actually penalize them.
I think it could, and I think that's been widely pointed out. There are a lot of questions about what would happen if do you really need to provide total financial support to wealthy families so that everyone has a free education, even if that means that you're going to have less resources to support those students who still have to pay their expenses. They may have free tuition, but they still got to pay their living expenses. Where's that money going to come from? If there's no contribution from wealthy families, unless it's all made up for by the government, but can you get the government to do that? And I think the idea of taxing Wall Street is an interesting idea, but that wouldn't cover the cost. So now, look, these are proposals that are being floated at this point. They're not pinned down in any level of detail. It's very hard to predict where they're going to come out. I have no idea where Mr. Trump stands on these issues, for example. Maybe you've seen coverage of this. I haven't seen any. And I think, we certainly know the Clinton administration, the previous Clinton administration. We have a good relationship with Secretary Clinton because she's taken an interest in health disparities in Washington, D.C. She founded an institute at our university called the Rodham Institute, which she founded in honor of her late mother, Dorothy Rodham, and which works with our faculty in medicine and public health to address disparities in health care across different levels of income within the District of Columbia. And that's been an important kind of partnership for us. But how that translates into a broader higher education policy, I couldn't really say. We're obviously all interested in the outcome of the election, but whoever's president, whoever's in the administration, these issues that we've been talking about today of affordability, of diversity, meaning how you ensure equal opportunity for everyone in society for the sake of democracy, if you're going to have a thriving democracy, and issues like sexual assault, those issues are not going to go away overnight because of whatever happens in the election. We're going to work with whatever administration comes in to continue to address them.
President Stephen Knapp, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.